This is Florida Matters Live and Local, sponsored by Badawi Law, and we're broadcasting from the Doctors Lorraine Rubus and Neil Frankel studio at WSF in Tampa. I'm Matthew Petty. Now, at the end of the semester, two Pinellas County schools will close. That's Cross Bayou Elementary and Distant Academy. An elementary school and a middle school will become one K-8 school. That's Bay Point Elementary and Middle. One elementary school will expand into a K-8 school, Oldsmar Elementary, and another elementary school will become home to the employee childcare program. That's McMullen Booth Elementary. So there's five schools in there, quite a lot to pay attention to, but if you are one of the parents or teachers or students involved in those, you know exactly what we're talking about. So more decisions about other schools in Pinellas County are expected this fall, and decisions like this are being made in school districts across Florida and the country as educators contend with dwindling enrollment and school buildings that cost more to repair than they're worth. Joining us to talk more about the current plans and what the future holds is Lee Bryant, president of the Pinellas Classroom Teachers Association. Lee, thank you for stopping by.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Also joined by Jennifer Dull, Chief Operations Officer with Pinellas County Schools. Jennifer, thank you as well.
Thank you for inviting us.
And Reagan Miller, parent and vice president of the Pinellas County Council for PTA. Reagan, thank you as well.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
And good morning to you. Actually, afternoon now.
But yeah, good afternoon.
We're only over by a couple minutes, so we're all good. So if you have a student at one of these Pinellas County schools, maybe you've experienced the closure of a merger of a school as a student or educator or parent in another county, you can join the conversation. Call 813-755-6562. That's 813-755-6562 or email floridamatters@wusf.org. All right, Jennifer, I want to start with you. What is going to happen to the teachers and the staff at these five schools?
So one of the things that through all these recommendations, no employee will lose their job as a result of the recommendations. So at some of these schools, things will remain the same. As an example, at Bay Point L and Bay Point Middle, that recommendation doesn't take effect until the following school year. Mm-hmm. For teachers and staff at the schools that were not only recommended but voted for closure this year, our HR department will work with them to ensure transition to another role at a different site in Pinellas County.
And can you give us an idea of how many teachers and students are involved in this or affected by it?
So the number of students across Bayou is around 245 students, and the number of students at Distant is around 52. With those recommendations, it's a little bit different because they're different type of schools. But for students at Cross Bayou, the board will go through a process of rezoning to both Bardmore Elementary and Pinellas Central Elementary, with the Deaf and Hard of Hearing program going to Walsingham Oaks K-8. If parents, just like any other choice in Pinellas County, if parents are looking for a different option, they went through our student assignment office and we've been working with those parents. Mm-hmm. As far as, and for Distant Academy, we're working individually because that is a program for students who have, had struggles in school, and we're working with them and their families individually to find the best program to meet their needs. Yeah. As far as the teachers and staff, for Distant, it's about 25 teachers and staff members. I don't have the numbers right offhand on Cross Bayou, but for all of those processes have already started. Teachers and staff have already met with HR when the recommendation was made and continue to work with them and will throughout the whole semester as they transition into the fall.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, a lot of moving parts, and it's almost kind of like a military operation in terms of putting all the people in the right spots. Lee, let me turn to you. What are you hearing from affected teachers?
Teachers are nervous because, we don't know what the future holds, especially long term. I remember when I grew up here in the Bay Area, when we were double sessioned because we didn't have nearly enough spaces for students. And
now you got the opposite problem.
And we have the opposite problem now. So it's actually in the contract that if there's a reduction in force, we have to work together. And that's great because we do work together well. Teachers are nervous because some teachers, especially teachers that have been at the same school for a very long time, think of that as their school instead of being an employee for Pinellas County Schools. And some people, that's their school. That's their identity.
Yeah. Okay. So, Reagan, speaking of that, I mean, what about parents? What are you hearing from them? And I imagine this kind of sense of ownership of the campus that you go to as a student. That's pretty important too. So what's the word that you're hearing from folks?
I mean, parents are stressed out. They, you know, they don't know what's going to happen to their school. I would say that there was a lot, you know, prior to the announcement, you know, a lot of rumors, and people, you know, weren't sure what was going to happen. And I think to Lee's point that we don't know what's going to happen in the future. I think, you know, some of us are sitting back saying, okay, I'm comfortable, I'm at this school and I'm fine. And others are going, wait, am I going to be combined? I think prior to the announcement, and Mrs. Dahl can certainly, and probably Mr. Bryant as well can say, my phone, I got texts every day. Is it my school? You know, people think that someone's in the know or they know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. The district did a really good job going around and talking about what the problem was, you know, declining birth rate, these underutilized buildings. I think there were 5 in total. Correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. But, you know, where they explained what the issue was, but nobody knew who was going to be impacted until I think it was January 20th or around that day, you know, when the decision came out, and, you know, and people are having to deal with that. And I think more difficult decisions are coming in the not too distant future. And people are wondering if it's them and what that means.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking about school closures and mergers, consolidation of schools in Pinellas County. Comes amid dropping enrollment. Maybe you're a parent who's concerned about how enrollment might affect the future of your child's school. Perhaps you're an educator with some perspective on the current state of public school education and enrollment. Maybe you're sort of worried about what's happening in your county or could happen soon. You can join the conversation by calling 813-755-6562 or emailing floridamatters@wusf.org. With us, Lee Bryant, President of Pinellas County Classroom Teachers Association, Jennifer Dahl, Chief Operations Officer with Pinellas County Schools, and Reagan Miller, Parent and Vice President of the Pinellas County Council for PTA. Jennifer, I mean, there were several community meetings before the final decision on closures. What did you learn from those?
So we have actually done a number of community meetings. We last fall did a series that was open to anyone in the community to make sure we heard feedback around what was important as the first round of kind of recommendations came out. And then following the recommendations, we also had individual community meetings with every single recommendation that came forward, and multiple at the 2 that were recommended for closure. I also want to thank Reagan for really kind of highlighting this point that while we talk about school enrollment, it's actually in Pinellas County a decline in school age population, young people that live here. So I think that is something that we were trying to make sure people understood. It's not just that schools no longer, like, the kids are going elsewhere. We're actually in Pinellas County. From the University of Florida's Bureau of Economic and Business Research through 2050 are set to still, as Pinellas County, see a decline in school age population, while the number of residents aged 80 plus are set to double. So while I definitely understand that as a community, it can feel unsettling right now as we go through and really kind of look at what does Pinellas County schools look like through the year 2050 and beyond. I also know that people recognize that the demographics of our county have changed and that we as a community need to be thoughtful around that planning.
Yeah.
And I think Lee definitely brought forward, and PCTA is definitely a partner with the district. But I do want to reiterate that it is not we are not in a reduction of force situation right now. If that were to come, that would be something we worked with the unions on. But right now, every person that is in Pinellas County, no one will lose their job as a result of these recommendations. And so I just want to make sure that that's really clear to our teachers and to our staff as we move forward in these recommendations.
Jennifer, real briefly, I just wanted to ask, how did Schools of Hope factor into this? Because we have talked to other school districts where they're worried about charter schools under the Schools of Hope program coming in and taking up unused campus space and school districts being left footing the bill for that. So is that part of the rationale for these particular schools that you're focused on sort of closing and merging and kind of reorienting?
So I think it was definitely a factor as we were learning more as we had started this process as a district. I think it's one factor, but I think as a larger community, we also had to look at all of the things coming together, including the school age population and the number of buildings we had. It is something that we look out there based upon what the legislation said in July and has now, you know, potentially based upon the state board rule that happened last week, is shifting a little bit around the capacity and percentages. So as a district, it is our responsibility to always know what that is and is part of how we look at the information as we move forward and make recommendations to our board. Absolutely.
Okay, I want to ask you, Lee, you know, you've been a teacher for 3 decades. Does the profession feel a little less secure now than it did when you started?
Well, there has been an uncomfortableness in the profession right now. We've had the problem with USF possibly closing their School of Education because they're having a hard time getting people into the profession, people who actually love the idea of teaching, and that's what their goal was their entire life. In Florida, we're 50th in teacher pay for several years in a row. So there's less of an incentive. It's expensive to go to college, and then you don't make the compensation to pay for that education that you got. So there is some trepidation about going into education right now.
Yeah. Just before we close out here, I wanted to give you the last word here, Reagan. I mean, thinking about this in the next 30 seconds, well, to sum up your thoughts, though, I mean, a little bit of trepidation from all concerned, I think. What's your message to other parents out there?
Just support your school, be involved, pay attention to what's going on. I know that parents are busy and you know, you're not obviously listening to, you're not going to every board meeting, you're not listening to everything, but you know, pay attention, stay close to your school, advocate for your school, and you know, and know that the district, the teachers union, everybody is, we're all working through this together,
Yeah.
and we all just need to show each other some grace and figure it out.
Reagan Miller, Parent and Vice President of the Pinellas County Council for PTA. Also joining us, Lee Bryant, President of the Pinellas County Classroom Teachers Association, and Jennifer Dell, Chief Operations Officer, Pinellas County Schools. Thank you so much, all of you.
Thank you. Coming up next,
we're going to talk a little bit about CENTCOM. It's based in Tampa. It's basically planning the bombardment of Iran right now. Talk about how that factors in. Welcome back to Florida Matters Live and Local. I'm Matthew Petty. In about 10 minutes, we're going to talk about nighttime curfews for teenagers in Manatee County. Communities are rolling them out. They're saying for the safety of teenagers. What do you think, though? Are they a wise move? Do they trample the rights of teenagers? You can email floridamatters@wsf.org and join the conversation in about 10 minutes. We're turning now to the war in Iran and its connection with Tampa Bay. U.S. and Israeli airstrikes on Iran have been directed out of Central Command, that's CENTCOM, at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa. For more about CENTCOM's role in the bombing campaign, Operation Epic Fury, and whatever follows, we're joined by Patricia DiGennaro. She's a geopolitical analyst and former strategic consultant for the United States Special Operations Command, the Central Command, and the Indo-Pacific Command. Patricia, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And if you've got questions about how this war is being waged, you can call 813-755-6562 or email floridamatters@wusf.org. All right, so break it down for us. What does CENTCOM do? How important is it to this U.S.-led war with Iran?
Well, CENTCOM is the central command, and it's oversees the area of the Middle East, including Iran, Afghanistan, the Gulf nations, and more recently, Israel has joined its oversight. So it's responsible for that area of operations. It's responsible for understanding each country, each military capabilities, how to operate. It's responsible also in allied relationship engagement and activities and exercises that they often do together in those regions. So to make sure they have interoperability and they work well together as well.
Now, CENTCOM actually kind of came about as a result of the coup that toppled the Shah of Iran back in 1979, right? So in some ways, without that, it wouldn't even exist. So talk us through that connection and how that developed.
Well, that's true. It developed from that area. So we could make sure that we understand the different consequences of operating in that area. I can't really talk you through exactly the steps, but you are correct on that particular aspect.
Now, President Trump's stated goals, or at least one of them, is to destroy Iran's military capability, remove what he says is a nuclear threat. Do you get the sense, though, there's some kind of unfinished business here? Is this about trying to kind of level the score from the hostage crisis that was, you know, more than 45 years ago?
I don't get that sense at all. I mean, I think this is a very interesting dynamic. We haven't really gotten a clear mission from the White House and the administration. They've been changing it quite a bit. I mean, yesterday they did come out with four points and parameters for this current mission. Mm-hmm. But it seems also that it's really being pushed from the Israeli administration in that perspective. And Donald Trump even spoke of that with Tucker Carlson recently, saying that he had no choice but to go to war with the Israelis and support the Israelis who were planning on striking Iran anyway.
Right. I think that I heard that one of the things that was said was that there's going to be some sort of response from Iran to an Israeli-led attack, so therefore the United States is better off getting in there first.
Well, that's quite possible. I mean, there were a lot of unverified rumors that the demonstrations that happened more recently were actually caused by CIA and Mossad infiltrations, or they were encouraged by. So that's one aspect of it that Iran may have been upset about. The other is the economic constraints that the U.S. put on Iran, which really took the U.S. currency out of the market and therefore caused a lot of the economic hardships that were going on within the small businesses and the community there. So nobody had a lot of access to the dollar. So the Iranian currency just went up. And we heard this from the Treasury Secretary mm-hmm. himself, that they put sanctions on certain banks in order to stop the any other access of the dollar that were getting around the current sanctions that were in place.
Yeah.
But I don't think Iran would have attacked Israel at this time, especially considering the negotiations that were going on with the U.S. and Iran and how close they were getting to a negotiated settlement, which was much better than the JCPOA. So this is a bit perplexing, I would say, for a lot of us as to why we had to go in and strike Iran at this time.
If you're just joining us on Florida Matters Live and Local, we're talking with Patricia DeGennaro, geopolitical analyst, former CENTCOM consultant, about the ongoing U.S. and Israeli bombing campaign in Iran. CENTCOM is based at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, and it's here the planning for this war is taking place. If you've got some questions about how this war is being waged, you can give us a call, 813-755-6562, or email floridamatters@wusf.org. So Operation Epic Fury, the bombing campaign, is one thing, but once that's over, you know, what comes next? We've heard some different messages from President Trump, from Pete Hegseth and others. You know, President Trump said the entire war could take weeks. How do you see it playing out, given what you know about Iran and the Middle East? Even if they do want to wrap this thing up in weeks, can the U.S. and Israel pull that off?
Well, this is a problem that the U.S. has repeatedly in several wars that it's gotten itself into, including we saw most recently in Afghanistan, is that, you know, they know how to plan a war and they know how to carry out operations, but they don't know quite what they're going to do next. We've seen this in Iraq, where, you know, we still have issues. We certainly saw it in Afghanistan, and I think it'll be the same situation in Iran. Iran is a country with a lot of different ethnicities and a lot of different, you know, types of people that are there, much like Afghanistan. So I think you're going to find a lot of internal strife if the Iranians can't get it together. But I will remind you that the Iranian government itself is very entrenched. I mean, it has very many levels down to it. So I think it's going to be more like, you know, the problem we had in Venezuela, where we can't get rid of the government. So, and if we can't control them, how are we going to, again, manage negotiations and engagement with them to get some kind of peace and stability back in the Middle East? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is affecting the whole region who's been brought in, and now we're seeing economic consequences as well with the gas and and oil industry, as we're seeing from the closing of the Straits of Hormuz.
Right, yeah. So lots to watch as this bombing campaign unfolds, as the kind of ramifications, the ripples spread out from Iran. Patricia De Janeiro, geopolitical analyst, former CENTCOM consultant, thank you so much for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, coming up next, if you're a teenager in some communities in Manatee County, you can't be out at night without an adult. What do you think about the curfews for teens? Are rights being infringed here? Or is this a good public safety move? Give us a call, 813-755-6562, and join the conversation. You can also send us an email. We're at floridamatters@wusf.org. We'll be back in a moment on Florida Matters Live and Local. Stay with us. Welcome back to Florida Matters Live and Local. I'm Matthew Petty. The city of Palmetto recently passed a curfew ordinance for teenagers. Kids under 16 years old can't be out by themselves from 11 p.m. to 5 a.m. Monday through Sunday, and from midnight to 6 a.m. on weekends. Some community members support the new rule. Others, like Manatee County NAACP President Tracy Washington, believe the new rule could do more harm than good. The new city curfew run ordinance mirrors the same ordinance passed by Manatee County Commissioners last November. With us to talk more about this ordinance, what it means, is Tracy Washington with NAACP. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me today.
We're also joined by Palmetto Police Chief Scott Tyler and Manatee County Sheriff Rick Wells. Chief Tyler and Sheriff Wells, thank you so much as well.
Thanks for having us.
And if you live in Palmetto, if you live in Manatee County, how do you feel about the curfew? If you don't live in either place, maybe you're concerned about your city or county could impose curfews. Maybe you think it's a good idea. Maybe you think it's good to get the teens off the streets by themselves late at night. Let us know, 813-755-6562. That's 813-755-6562 to call in, or you can email floridamatters@wusf.org. Chief Tyler, let me start with you. What are the details of this ordinance? Just kind of talk us through what it is and how it would work.
So this ordinance mirrors Florida State Statute 877, which has been on the books for quite a while. It's actually, it mirrors it exactly. And to be enforceable in a community, the Florida statute has to be adopted by the local government. So that's what the city of Palmetto did. That's what Manatee County did back in November. Mm-hmm. And the city of Bradenton also has a similar ordinance that they already have on the books.
Okay, so what happens if teens are out there late at night by themselves? I mean, how are you anticipating this will work from an enforcement perspective?
Well, first of all, I look back at data going back a year or two, and for the group of young people that this ordinance would impact, it's young people under 16. We don't have a lot of contact with them in the wee hours of the morning. We do have some, but not much. Mm-hmm. So the way this would work was if a young person is encountered in another law enforcement interaction out there during those hours, they're under 16. They're not with an adult caregiver, and they're not involved with one of several exceptions to the ordinance, then basically we would contact their parents, mm-hmm. make sure their parents knew where they were, and we would get them home, either the parents.
But isn't that what you would normally do anyway? I mean, do you actually need an ordinance to do this? Because that just sounds like the kind of typical actions that a police officer would take.
Well, certainly, but... you know, the ordinance didn't just come about with the city or the county, with the sheriff's office or the police department saying we need this. This was also in reaction to several other groups, including the Manatee County School District and civic groups that kind of came to law enforcement and said, hey, we have a problem with some young people being out in the wee hours of the morning all night, some of them getting into trouble, some of them involved with crime, violent crime, others being victims of violent crime. And Manatee County, along with I think a lot of places across the country, has a very serious problem with juvenile truancy, with kids not being in school. So I think that this is just one tool that law enforcement offered. It was an opportunity to maybe put some rules and make sure that kids are at home when they need to be.
Sheriff Wells, your rationale for the kind of county level ordinance, like, do you see a significant juvenile crime problem late at night?
Yeah, we have. Once again, thanks for having me. I want to echo what Chief Tyler said. This was not initiated by law enforcement. In the county, the ministers of justice were meeting with Omar Edwards from the school district. They were voicing their concerns, what they were seeing in their own communities. And also, the school district was also noticing kids coming in late or not coming in at all, or being tired when they did
Right.
come to school. So they went to the county commission and then asked for our support. So we just want to get the kids home safely to their parents. And if the parents don't know they're out, they're not going to know what their child is doing out here in our community. So for us, what I've instructed my deputies to do is just get these kids home where they can remain safe, because we have had issues out here with them being victimized just because they're out at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Right. So, Tracy, with the NAACP in Manatee County, your take on this, is this a good move, this curfew for teens?
Well, my input of all of this would be, we're looking at a curfew when, instead of addressing the root causes of youth violence or late night disturbances or lack of safe spaces, we have limited programming. Economic hardships, traumas, lack of mentorships. And I feel that we're shifting the burden onto the young person, who's really not causing the harm. If we had the resources in place in our communities, then yes, I could see moving forward. But until we've tried an alternative, to help the children, then why enforce a curfew before then? Because curfews don't replace parenting. Curfews don't replace mentorships. And curfews definitely do not replace investment in our youth.
Got a call coming in from Douglas. Douglas is on the line. What are you thinking, Douglas?
Yes, good morning or good afternoon all. Thank you so much for receiving my call, and thank you all for being there. I'm a black man in Hillsborough County practicing law, and before I heard the statement from law enforcement, my first real concern was that of having yet another mechanism to over-police marginalized groups of people, young people, what have you. But after hearing that this ordinance came from not from the mouths of law enforcement, but put on the shoulders of law enforcement. And with all due respect, I think the NAACP's Manatee response is disingenuous, as the only thing that was being said is that law enforcement is being instructed to return children home. My fear of children being removed from their families, my fear of children getting criminal records as they would normally go when they go to school. I think truancy is a real issue, but I do not believe it to be fair to lay it at the feet of law enforcement. And I commend law enforcement leadership for instructing them to take them home and not to detention centers and not to jail, where they'll be further victimized. As we all know, young people out at night are either working or preyed upon. But let us not forget that Ron DeSantis allowed us to allow young people to work because he's trying to fill the gap. So we lower the age to allow individuals to work. So we are going to be seeing younger and younger people working as we try to fill the void that is the employment issue. Thank you all. I take my response off air, and God bless each and every one of you. Good day.
All right, Douglas, thanks for that call. Quite a lot of ground to cover there. Tracy, what about that? I mean, is this putting too much on the shoulders of law enforcement, as our caller said?
And I would have to agree with that, because I don't feel like truancy is a law enforcement problem. Truancy,
Well, it's also not happening late at night unless kids are going
right?
to kind of after
Absolutely,
school programs.
absolutely. So I have to agree with what he just said.
Let me sort of put that back to you, Sheriff Wells. What about that? I mean, do you feel like this is going to be, in one case, over policing, or is it just putting more of a burden on your deputies out there?
Well, I think if we take our responsibility seriously, what we do, you know, we're out here to help these kids, and we always have been. So, you know, first and foremost, this is not a criminal offense. You know, we work very hard to make sure that minors are not given a criminal record, and we have programs in place to even clean their record if for some reason they do have a criminal record. So it's a civil citation, but once again, our deputies are going to be out here working these zones. They know a lot of the people in the zone. They know some of these minors. And I'll just go back to the same thing I said earlier. We just want to get them home safe. That is it. That is the only goal that Magic County Sheriff's Office has.
Mm. Hey, Tracy, when you hear that, I mean, are you reassured or do you still have concerns? I mean, like inserting law enforcement into that kind of passage of a kid who's out late back to their home safely, any concerns there?
So my concern is history shows us that policies like this often impact certain neighborhoods and certain communities more than others. And we can't support measures that risk increasing unnecessary contact between law enforcement and the youth. So my thing is, you know, I'm still standing on the portion of I don't want the kids to be over-policed, and I don't want them to be over-governed. And all kids aren't bad kids. We do have some good kids, and I don't want the good kids to fall into the play of being guilt by association at the same time. And I understand what Sheriff Wells is saying. They just want to get the kids home safe.
Mm-hmm.
But what if in that time when they're trying to get the child home safe, if the child doesn't stop, you know, when law enforcement comes, because we know that in our neighborhoods, most of us are intimidated when it comes to law enforcement. So when that child takes off and run from an officer, when he doesn't answer how old he is or who he is, or what happens then? Where are we left at that point? Because with law enforcement, we all know, you know, in all actuality, let's just tell it like it is, all officers aren't good officers. So where does that leave our children if they run once again?
I wanted to just kind of put a question to you then, I guess, Chief Tyler with Palmetto Police. Like, what's the thought process about how you kind of roll this out? Like, are you putting in extra training for the officers to make sure there aren't kind of situations like what Tracy's describing where, you know, maybe a kid runs from the police and something bad happens because of misunderstanding or miscommunication?
So we have had department dialogue once the ordinance was put in place. Our officers are aware of it. But again, I go back to we don't have an awful lot of contacts with young people as it is. But I also feel it's important to have this ordinance in the city of Palmetto, if it's in the county, and if it's in the city of Bradenton right across the river. I think it's important to be consistent with the ordinance and with our messaging to young people and families. So you know, getting back to your original question, I don't foresee a lot of contacts, negative or otherwise, with young people. But if we do come in contact with kids and they're not out in one of the, you know, in the capacity of one of the exceptions to the ordinance, then you know, the whole thing's about, as the sheriff said, getting them home safely.
Yeah.
Contacting their families and arranging to get them home.
I wonder though, I mean, are there opportunities you're looking for to increase positive contact so that there is that sort of good working relationship between families and police or kids and police? So, you know, that, as you say, if there isn't a lot of contact already, maybe that first contact isn't going to be necessarily a positive outcome. So how do you overcome that? Like what process do you go through there?
Well, I think in Manatee County, all law enforcement works very, very hard to develop a relationship with the community and, you know, to develop, you know, decent working relationships. I acknowledge that a lot of kids have a negative view of law enforcement. A lot of kids try to avoid contact with law enforcement. But, you know, here again, it's all about just trying to have a constructive contact. It's not a criminal ordinance. In fact, the state statute and certainly our ordinances say that the first contacts are a warning. It's not the $50 fine that it becomes if the same child is consistently out. So, you know, I think that we're built around trying to continue to foster positive contact.
Yeah. In the last 30 seconds or so we have here, Tracy, what are you going to be paying attention to in the kind of coming days and weeks as these ordinances are sort of put in place?
Just this, to make sure, like I said, that the children are over-policed. I just want to make sure that the children get home safe to their parents. Because this ordinance, it elevates the chances of contact with law enforcement either way. Mm. And I don't want to see the children either in the system, you know, or anything happening. And then we're set up for hundreds of lawsuits in our community. We don't need that. So I'm just looking into getting some programs out there so that we can supplement that. Because if I'm going to be the author saying that we don't have programming, why don't we put some in place? So that's what I'm looking forward to. Thank you.
So some work to do. Well, thank you so much, Tracy Washington, president of the Manatee County NAACP. Really appreciate your time. And also thanks to our other guests, Palmetto Police Chief Scott Tyler and Manatee County Sheriff Rick Wells. Well, coming up, going to hear from a local author about her postpartum journey. Ayanna Large opens up about her mental health struggles after having her daughter. That's when Florida Matters Live and Local continues. Stay with us. Welcome back to Florida Matters Live and Local. I'm Matthew Petty. Fertility struggles and pregnancy journeys have been well documented, but the mental toll of childbirth and being a parent receives less attention. According to the National Institutes of Health, approximately 75% of pregnant people do not receive treatment for mental health symptoms. Now, if you or a loved one has gone through struggles in their postpartum journey, you can join the conversation. Give us a call. We're at 813-755-6562. That's 813-755-6562. You can also email floridamatters@wsf.org. Well, following the birth of her daughter, Ayanna Lage, a local blogger, struggled severely with her mental health. Despite having experienced mental health challenges for much of her life, she realized she still had lingering misconceptions about people receiving inpatient psychiatric care. In her memoir, Ayanna draws from her notebooks and medical records. Missing Me is an exploration of Ayanna's psychotic episode following the birth of her first child. And the book is available on March 17th. Ayanna Lage joins us now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, you cover some pretty vulnerable topics in your book. I mean, you really kind of lay it all out there. So why did you feel moved to share this, your struggle and your journey in this way?
As I was recovering from postpartum psychosis, I went to school for journalism, so I love research. So I was searching for people who'd been through the same thing, Facebook groups, you know, books, articles, and I was shocked by how little there was out there. I mean, there were resources that existed, but it was nowhere near what you'd find for postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety. Mm-hmm. So once I felt ready to look back at it and write about it, I kind of had a mindset of, if I can help even one person by sharing my story, help them feel less alone, then, you know, it's worth it for me.
Have you heard from folks?
Yes, I have. Yeah. Which has been the most rewarding experience.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, like any author, because you're kind of, it's a lot of work to write a book, right? So, and it can be a pretty solitary experience. So I imagine sort of having that connection from your readers must be an amazing experience.
Oh, yeah. It's very easy, I feel, to get lost in the work in a good way, but also in a bad way. It's kind of nice to have something that grounds you outside of that.
Well, let me just read a little bit. This is from the introduction of the sixth chapter. It's pretty stunning stuff. Quote, because he is Satan, the so-called psychiatrist is also overseeing the hospital's illegal experiments. The doctors at the hospital hold secret meetings to figure out how to bring down people with special powers. At least one patient on the ward also hears from God, though I'm not sure I believe her proclamations. Also, some nurses are patients in disguise trying to trick me. They aren't doing this independently. Dr. Ramirez has engineered the whole thing to mess with me. Right, so that kind of really puts you in it. This is what you were going through there. I mean, it sounds terrifying. I got to say, though, just kind of reading through some of the first parts of the book, it's also quite funny, like just the way you describe God speaking to you and then your husband trying to kind of figure out what on earth is happening
here.
So, yeah, talk me through that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I always assumed that if I ever lost touch with reality or my, you know, rational side, that there'd still be a part of me that would push through and know, like, okay, something's off here, you know, this isn't true, you know, something's wrong. And that is not the case when you're experiencing psychosis. I fully believed all of these delusions that I was experiencing. I was very distressed about the fact that no one else around me seemed to see what I was seeing. And I thought that my life was in danger. So it was, I was full of adrenaline all the time. I wasn't sleeping. I was just overwhelmed by the sense that something terrible was going to happen to me or to my daughter, mm-hmm. who was at home at that point. I was in an inpatient unit. She was at home with my husband. So yeah, I mean, thank you for saying that it was funny. I think that there are parts of it that were so absurd that I kind of had to look at it and say, okay, you know, this, it's hard to believe that this happened, but, you know, it did. So that's that. Like, you know, what else can I do with that experience other than share it?
Yeah, you had to sort of lean into it.
Yeah.
And I mean, the other thing that struck, one of the other things that struck me was the fact that you kept all of this material, right? That you had notebooks, you had kind of stuff that you'd saved from your experience in hospital. I think you had like a half empty bottle of shampoo. You just kind of put all this stuff aside and you weren't sure how to deal with it. So at some point you had to kind of go back through and read through some of your notes. Like, that experience must have been quite challenging too, I imagine.
It was. I think that I've always been a bit of a pack rat and also like a little bit sentimental when it comes to different things. So I did keep all of this material, not sure that I'd ever need it for anything. But once I started thinking about the book, I went back into my hospital records, hundreds of pages of records, and read through them. And it was honestly excruciating. I don't know that I'd recommend that to the average person. I don't know that I would do that again. But I learned a lot about myself, and I learned a lot about how I was perceived while I was in that situation, in that mental state. And I gained a lot from it. So I'm glad that I kept the notebooks. I'm glad that I kept the records, and I'm glad that it helped me form the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, you kind of describe how, you know, this had been something you dealt with earlier in your life, right? The kind of what, you know, later became a full-blown episode of psychosis, which must have been quite scary too, but you'd sort of experienced a version of this growing up. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I lived through depression and anxiety starting as a preteen all the way up into college, where I finally started to receive treatment for it. Mm-hmm. So I was familiar with not being in the right mental state and not having yourself together the way that you wanted to be together. But I think there was still a part of me that viewed myself as like an acceptable version of mentally ill. And, you know, at least I'm not someone who has a scary illness or something that is actually bad. You know, I can handle being anxious and being depressed. I'm used to it. So it was definitely, it was a little bit of a humbling reality check to experience psychosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Now, being an African-American woman in America, you know, there are a lot of challenges, right? Like inadequate health care. Sometimes there's the pregnancy and mortality rates. Those are pretty high too. Did this sort of shape your perception of how you experienced what you went through?
I had a very difficult childbirth that ended in an emergency C-section. And I do think that had I been able to advocate for myself more during that process leading up to the emergency, that I would have had a different outcome. So I definitely felt very aware of my status as a Black woman in the medical system. Mm-hmm. So that definitely was always on my mind. Through, you know, psychosis, although my mind wasn't all the way there, so I wasn't always thinking clearly, but it was definitely something that I was thinking about.
Yeah, so there were parts of you that could kind of, that were able to take a step back and say, I can tell some of what's happening, and
yes,
sort of there was some level of reality there.
Yes.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Ayana Lage. She's the author of Missing Me. It's a memoir about postpartum psychosis. Now, if you've got thoughts or questions about mental health during postpartum, during childbirth, or any part of that, you can join the conversation by calling 813-755-6562. That's 813-755-6562, or emailing floridamatters@wusf.org. This was happening too, like around the time of COVID, right? So that's an extra layer of stress to deal with.
Yeah, this was August of 2020. Mm-hmm. So while I was in the hospital, I couldn't see my husband or my child. There were no visitors allowed due to pandemic restrictions. And that also, I think, just compounded everything that I was feeling, because I had a delusion that my daughter wasn't real. And I think that obviously, like, not being able to talk to my husband and be reassured face to face, okay, she exists, you know, here's a picture of her, anything like that. Missing out on that, I think, definitely made it even harder to live through.
Yeah. Was that a thought or a fear that you had before your pregnancy? Had you sort of read about postpartum depression and some of what people go through, you know, after giving birth?
I was extremely prepared for postpartum depression. I knew that I was at higher risk because of my mental health history. And I felt like, okay, I can do this. I'd heard of postpartum psychosis, but only in the context of the headlines that you see that are terrifying and scary and awful. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't something in my mind that would ever happen to a regular person like me. I felt pretty insulated from that, and I felt prepared, you know, for the mental health condition that I expected to have. And nothing really could have prepared me for what I went through.
Now, you write in the book about God speaking to you. Like, one of the first things you hear, one of these first visions is like, you're going to write a bestseller. So just kind of talk us through that. Put the listener in your shoes at that moment.
I was in my room in bed trying to fall asleep, and I heard the loudest voice say, you're going to write a best-selling book one day. And I was so excited. I turned to my husband. I was like, you won't believe this, but I'm hearing this voice telling me this. And I'd had mood swings and acted erratically in the days leading up to this moment, but there was nothing to clearly suggest, okay, this is a psychotic break, until I started to hear voices. So I got this word that I'm going to be an author, and then I started to hear from God that he wanted me to rewrite the Bible. So the notebooks that I kept throughout psychosis are my version of the Bible that I was trying to write, with all of the voices that I was hearing, keeping track of what I was being told.
Mm-hmm. Now you're kind of in the position where you are. You're obviously, you know, a lot more centered. You've kind of tackled some of the biggest challenges around the, you know, the postpartum psychosis. And has your relationship with religion changed at all?
I think my relationship with religion was complicated even before the episode, but I had a difficult time reconciling the faraway God that, you know, is in heaven, that, you know, some of us believe in, who we worship, with my reality for 3 weeks, where I had a God who was whispering in my ear constantly and telling me everything and telling me I was special and that there was no one like me. And I couldn't, you know, real God, if you believe in God. But when I returned to it and kind of reckoned with Christianity, that felt boring. I was right. Like, I miss hearing words from God. This is not what it could be. Mm-hmm. So I think that even now, my relationship with faith is definitely like a little bit tricky. But I did learn a lot through the experience, and I do think that it did shape me in a good way.
Mm-hmm. And what about your relationship with your family? Like, how is that now? Because I imagine this whole experience must have been quite terrifying for them too.
Yeah, I mean, I dive into it in the book, but I was terrible to my family. I would call them from the hospital and yell at them and tell them that they were going to hurt my daughter, that my husband was cheating on me, that they were murderers. So I, as I came back to myself, had to reckon with the fact that I'd been so awful and so cruel to the people that loved me most. And I think that they were very forgiving and just glad to have me back and weren't holding anything against me. But I honestly still feel some guilt for the way that I treated my loved ones. It was difficult.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave the conversation there. But Ayana Lage, author of Missing Me, the memoir is available to purchase on March 17th. Thank you so much. Congratulations on the book.
Me. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, tomorrow on Florida Matters Live and Local, St. Petersburg Mayor Ken Welch joins us. He's running for a second term. If you've got questions for Mayor Welch, what do you want him to focus on if he's re-elected? Call 813-755-6562 and leave a message and join the conversation noon on Wednesday. That's our show for today. Florida Matters Live and Local executive producer is Grayson Doctor. Our producers are Amelie Horace and Quincy Walters. Our engineers are Jackson Harp and Geo Garvin. And Jackson composed our theme music. Chandler Balcom handled the video today. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Watch on WSF's YouTube channel. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks so much for being with us, and we'll see you at noon tomorrow.